Thank you very much, Tom and indeed Tim. It's nice to be back here. I've been here twice before, once for the wedding of a very good friend and once for a memorial service for her mother, more recently, where I got fingered to come and do this talk. I'm glad I was reminded to turn off my mobile phone. I think my worst experience of failing to do so was probably in the Royal Courts of Justice, where I'd been asked to stand in for Sir Ian Kennedy, who wasn't available. And I was sitting next to Brenda Hale, later Lady Hale, the President of the Supreme Court. And I'd forgotten that I had been doing some maths prep with my daughter, a timed maths problem. And my phone wasn't on silent. And I'd put, I think it was on silent, a stopwatch on, a clock on to make sure I didn't overrun my 15 minutes. Cuckoo clock started going off in the Royal Courts of Justice. So I managed, I think, without moving my elbows to sort of turn it off. As far as I could tell, none of the assembled judges was sufficiently good of hearing to realize anything had happened at all. And Brenda was kind enough not to mention anything about it. So I think I got away with it. So if it does go off, please, I won't be too upset. As Tom said, there's lots of ways in which matters of life and death and bioethical reasoning have touched my career. I was, for example, in COVID, asked by Steve Powis and Chris Whitty to work with a couple of clinicians on critical care triage criteria. So how you decided who should go into intensive care if we didn't have sufficient beds. And I took that to a meeting that the Sunday Times described on its front page as having a smack of Nazi Germany about it. Because these are really difficult decisions to make, and they matter a lot. So I'm going to talk to you around the way in which our society has grappled with whether or not we should create a legal framework to allow medically assisted dying, but I'm going to touch on a range of issues that come up in lots of other areas as well, and I'm very happy to go wherever the conversation goes when I finish my set piece. And I want to begin that with the stories of two rugby players. The first is Matt Hampson, who was a prop for Leicester Tigers development squad, was expected probably to get full international honours with England, but was less paralysed from the neck down in 2005. The scrum collapsed. He was training with the England Under-21 squad, and he had this catastrophic injury. And his response was to set up a charitable foundation whose purpose is to inspire and support young people who are seriously injured through sport. And if you Google him, you can find lots of stuff that they do. And another rugby player played for England Under-16s and England Students, was expected to turn professional, but was paralyzed in an accident in 2007. 18 months later, having attempted to take his own life unsuccessfully, Daniel James chose to travel to Switzerland to take advantage of the fact that in Switzerland, and this is why the cases are mostly about Switzerland, their laws permitting assisted dying don't have strict residence requirements. So whereas most countries that have taken steps to permit medically assisted dying have the requirement there's a connection between the people who want to have that and the country, Switzerland allows, if you like, euthanasia tourism. You can fly in, you can get support from a clinic, and that will enable you to do something that you can't do in your home country. And you can go there, that could be the first time that you have visited Switzerland. So Daniel James traveled to Switzerland and took advantage of that. But that's something that not only does the law not permit him in the UK, but his family could be prosecuted for assisting him in making that trip. They weren't prosecuted, and it's actually extremely rare for prosecution to happen, but the possibility is there. So you have already a sort of mismatch between the statements we want to make through our legal rules about what is valuable and what you should do, and the practicalities of what, if you like, you might get away with. I work at University College London. at which there is the stuffed remains of Jeremy Bentham, a very famous utilitarian, whose theory of law was essentially the way to think about law is that it's like a big stick. And what matters is that it's someone telling you to do something and will punish you if you don't do it. The consequence of which is sort of if you get away with it and it's not enforced, it doesn't really count as law. There's another grand tradition which says that what we should really worry about is whether or not the rules that we have in our law are consistent with the values that we think are proper. So a law is not really a law in the sense that it ought to be, unless it coincides with our sense of the moral expectations and requirements of us. So in a sense, we're exploring in these discussions a little bit about what are our expectations of a legal system of regulation in a very tricky area on which, as I've just illustrated with those two rugby players, we know that people have different responses and different views. I think both of those young men are brave, but their responses are very different. So that reminds us then that we have to address these questions of matters of life and death on the basis that we live in a pluralist society, a society where people have different senses of what matters most, different ways of prioritizing things that matter to them, different understandings about how we should approach these things. And we see those differences between people who care a lot about it, think a lot about it. So we can't dismiss the range of views as not mattering. We have to recognize that they're genuinely, reasonably held. We don't disagree because we think they're straightforward or easy. We disagree despite the fact we think they matter a lot and they're really hard. So in my work, I'm really interested both in terms of my public service work with various committees and also my academic work to understand how we should go about trying to grapple with the fact that we don't agree on important things. And it's really important to remember that this doesn't suggest that we don't think things matter. There are some people who argue that, well, we've moved away from a time where we care about the truth or we care about morality. It's all relative, it's all what people choose, it's a consumer society. The way we talk about this suggests that that's wrong. People really think they are trying to find the right way and they want to explain to other people why their way is the right way and they want to persuade them. So we debate these things with some passion. We're not talking across each other and thinking that it's just a different choice about clothes or getting up on the different side of the bed. We want to engage in trying to get it right. So how do we go about that? If we had any doubt that this mattered to people, when the privately commissioned Fulcher Inquiry looked at assisting dying in 2011, it had over 1,200 responses from individuals and organisations wanting to make points about the right way of thinking about it and the right way forward. It held a whole load of public hearings. It took commissioned research. It produced a report of over 400 pages with 1,000 endnotes. That, in my world, 1,000 endnotes is a sign of authority and hard work. In most people's words, it's rather turgid and suggests that maybe you just want to go to the recommendations. But the point here is that a lot of effort is going into trying to get this right. So I want to talk a bit about how we might resolve them. Because if the first thing that strikes me about our problem is that we know that we live in a pluralist society where people think differently, that we know we live in a society where people care about getting it right, so we're not going to be sidetracked into the suggestion it doesn't matter. We then have to work on what do we want to use to find a solution to these disagreements. Because it doesn't seem right that someone should be under threat of criminal offence prosecution unless we think there's a good foundation for that. So I'm going to talk about three ways in which we have attempted to address that, using parliamentary processes, using litigation, and using what I'll describe as deliberative democratic process, getting everybody together and talk about it. And I'm going to end up by suggesting that's what we're about to do when we have a conversation about engaging something about those sorts of things. And there is a sort of standard view on this, which is that we expect difficult decisions in our society in which we disagree to resolve democratically. So in a case involving Tony Bland, who was crushed at the Hillsborough Stadium disaster, who lived for many years afterwards and whose family felt had died long before his body was allowed to go, and made all the way to the House of Lords to clarify that it was permissible to allow him to die. The judge, Lord Brown Wilkinson, said, "No, the moral and social and legal issues raised by this case should be considered by Parliament. Judges' function in this area of law should be to apply the principles which society through democratic processes adopts, not to impose their standards on society." Now, there are lots of reasons for thinking this hasn't gone very well, and I'll just outline a few of them. So first of all, this is an area where it's quite difficult to get Parliament to take reach any resolution. There's a bill before Parliament on assisted dying about every 18 months coming through privately. Traditionally, governments have not wanted to go anywhere near it. Traditionally, when MPs were invited to vote on it, it's what's called a vote of conscience. So the party whips don't say, "We think this is the right way that you should vote." Now, when you vote for your MPs, I'm sure one of the things you take into account is the parties they affiliate to, and you have a sense of what they're claiming to stand for. It's not very likely that in their letters that come through the door and whatever, it will tell you very much about what they would think about assisted dying or embryo research or these sorts of things. So we don't quite know what the connection is between the MPs we ask to vote on this, if they're not being guided by anything else, and democracy. Now, there are countries in the world where we can remedy that, and I'll come back to that later on, by just having a referendum. I'm not sure what your view on referenda in our recent experience is, but it doesn't seem to have stopped the discussion about what we should be doing. But even more importantly, we are at a stage where we have a significant crisis of trust in our institutions, including our MPs, and on something as significant for individual lives as this, it's not obvious that we are confident that we've got the right body of people. And when you look at what's happened, there are even more reasons for worrying about whether or not we've satisfactorily addressed these questions through Parliament. So Daniel James, the lad who went to Switzerland, the law that blocked him getting some help in ending his own life dates back to 1961. It dates back to a time where we decided, for reasons of humanity, that it wasn't appropriate to prosecute people who attempted suicide and failed. You never could attempt to prosecute people who succeeded in committing suicide, but you could prosecute people who attempted and failed. And we realized that that was not the appropriate response to what is very often a cry for help. And so we decriminalized suicide. And at the same time, alongside it, we created an offense of assisting suicide. Because there's an immediate worry that if you were to allow people to be assisted in suicide, it could hide what were actually murders, that people make it look like a suicide. And therefore, we tried to make sure we could draw a distinction between murder and assisted suicide, and we passed the legislation, which has broadly remained unchanged with a bit of change of wording in 2009 since then. So we have a piece of legislation whose job was to try and make sure that vulnerable people were not murdered, which we're now trying to make work for an area which, whatever language you want to describe, tries to distinguish between good deaths, euthanasia of various sorts, and bad deaths, exploited deaths, misguided decisions. And you would expect, if our model of parliamentary democracy works well, that we would have looked at how to improve on that at some point in between now and 1961. And Parliament's had lots of opportunities to do that. But what happens is that they've rejected so far all the alternatives on the basis that they don't satisfactorily address some of the risks of taking this step. Now, I'm not criticising them for not adopting any of the particular examples that are there, and I'll show you the most recent one in a moment. It's quite right, it seems to me, for our elected representatives to say this is a big step for us to take. And if we were to take a step allowing aiding and abetting suicide, we would be unable to step back from that very easily. It's not impossible. Some countries have managed to do it. But it is a big step, and it's reasonable to make sure that we should take that step carefully. And what we do before we take that step is a sort of fudge. We rely on the fact that the Director of Public Prosecutions won't actually prosecute people, even though that's what the law says should happen, in order to stop the law becoming into disrepute. Or if I'm trying to be kinder, you know, we say we are exercising a prerogative of mercy to temper justice with mercy. Now, it seems that it's perfectly reasonable then to say we should take this step cautiously, but to suggest that we've been unable to find a way forward in, well, that is 60 years, that doesn't seem to reflect very well on our democratic processes. Because what you should do if you have an unacceptable alternative is to keep working and see, well, what is the right thing to do? And we've not actually done that. We've not said this act is the right act. We've said none of the alternatives are yet good enough to take that step. So where are we currently before Parliament? Well, the recent version, which was put before Parliament in the last session by Baroness Meacher, I'll just summarise it, not read you the whole thing. It was based on the idea that there were three things that we should try and establish in order to take this step. First of all, we wanted the people seeking assistance in dying to be terminally ill. Now, this is probably a sort of cop-out. If you're terminally ill, it's not really a decision for death rather than life, because someone's going to die anyway. It's just a question about timing. That puts it in conflict with the other major argument that's used in relation to assisted dying, which is that we should have choices over our own lives, and if someone doesn't want to live any longer, they should be permitted to do so. But if that's your rationale for wanting to allow someone to have assistance in suicide, you shouldn't limit it to only people who are terminally ill. And as soon as you do limit it to terminally ill, you have some technical challenges. So they go on to say, well, terminally ill means reasonably expected to die within 6 months. You can never know that, but it's a reasonable judgment to make. How long do you think someone's going to last? And then we say, well, that's fine. If they refuse treatment, they're going to die within 6 months. So we then want to overlay on that in our definition. Well, they have an inevitably progressive condition, which you can't reverse by treatment, expected to die within 6 months, and then you get labelled as terminally ill, and then you become eligible for this step. But only if you're over the age of 18, and only if you have been resident in England and Wales for a year. So we don't want to be the Swiss tourism. We can have a good argument later. We were having it before about, well, what's having an age limit? Tell us about the justifications for that. We're trying to create here, tactically, for those who want to change the law, a sort of scenario which is quite hard to disagree with. Quite hard to disagree with the fact that someone who's about to die, who we can't do anything for, couldn't be allowed to have a bit of control over the timing of death. Particularly if they pass the third test, which is in the statute, it's voluntary, clear, settled, and informed decision that they've made. Because we say, you know, they want it. There's no better option available to them. Some versions have had their unbearable pain and suffering. But because previous versions have just failed to get through the parliamentary hurdle, they're currently suggesting, well, you only count as having a voluntary, clear, settled, and informed wish if you can produce evidence to a High Court judge witnessed by one of your relatives or carers, countersigned by two doctors, that you have a voluntary, clear, settled, and informed wish, because that's the only thing that will give us confidence. Now, what's going on here is a sort of horse trading. They're trying to make it more and more difficult for someone to say this is not a compelling case to allow someone to make that choice. But the more they do that, the more legalistic they make it, and more people will fall outside of the scope of that choice. And it doesn't reflect terribly well on the desire for us to have a good, consistent moral basis for our rules when you get all the splitting of hairs in the definitions. So you can see from that I wouldn't score our parliamentary process terribly high in terms of they've dealt with this. If not Parliament, is it any better when the judges get to go of it? Well, we've seen an awful lot of judging on these issues around assisted dying, And that's created quite a big constitutional challenge for us, because, as I said earlier, we think we should do these things democratically. And we don't think judges are very representative of the population. And we are worried that they might impose their own values on the rest of us. Now, what we've seen in litigation is a significant amount of campaigning. So we've got people pushing, wanting to push the law, who've been able to stack up deserving cases who have our sympathy in order to try and build pressure for changing the law. It happens in the context of assisted dying to be people pushing an autonomy agenda, but you see it in relation to termination of pregnancy, of people pushing a so-called pro-life agenda. It means that people who have the will and the money and the opportunity to get things in front of the court get a louder voice than they might otherwise do. And they have managed to suck the judges into dangerous territory. So early on, case involving Diane Pretty, the judges said this wasn't really an issue for them. It wasn't really about human rights. But they got taken to the European Court of Human Rights and told it was about human rights. And a few years later, 2009, they were persuaded that the uncertainty of being prosecuted when you go to Switzerland was so unacceptable that the Director of Public Prosecutions had to be ordered to draw up a new policy which would explain exactly when you were and weren't going to be prosecuted. You may remember the Director of Public Prosecutions of the time, Keir Starmer, squirming a little bit when being asked about this in Parliament. Duly, the DPP did that and realised that it created a major constitutional problem, because the clearer you are about when someone's going to be prosecuted, the more you're drawing a line between what's acceptable and what isn't, and you're not a legitimate legislator. So they pulled back a little bit from that. So the campaigners went back to court and persuaded the Supreme Court in a case in 2015 that they should actually put a big marker down and tell Parliament, you haven't done well enough on this, you really have to change it, because what we have at stake here is a fundamental human right to control your own life, and that includes the manner of your dying. And there has to be a compelling reason for not permitting people to do that. The Supreme Court at the time was pretty confident that Parliament was about to change the law and said, no, yes, there is a human rights issue here, and it's what we have is not acceptable. And they were split on it quite how they expressed it, but they essentially put a marker down indicating that if Parliament didn't change the law, then it would be open for the courts to say they must do so, make what's called a declaration of incompatibility with the European Convention on Human Rights. Unfortunately for the judges' assumptions, Parliament did discuss it, but didn't change the law. So there's a couple of things around that which are quite interesting. One is about just the tactics. It turned out that the parliamentary process that was used was a private member's bill in the House of Commons, and the campaigners had lined up lots of members of the House of Lords to be sympathetic and brief them, and they hadn't put the same effort into the House of Commons, and they therefore didn't have the same ability to persuade MPs that they seem to have managed to create for members of the House of Lords. And of course, the Supreme Court justices know the members of the House of Lords rather better than they know the MPs. So they misjudged the tactics, and that meant the court misjudged the position it was in. So the campaigns went back to the court again and said, this isn't quite how they put it, but they said essentially, you know, you told us last time that you would take a position on this. Parliament hasn't addressed it, so please take a position. And they ducked it. They explained that this was a very important public issue. They explained that they had different reasons, different views amongst the Supreme Court justices, but they didn't think it would be of any help to the particular person bringing the case for it to be heard in the Supreme Court, and refused to hear it, a decision which I think mystifies me. So it seems, again, that we had a mechanism for getting to grips with this, and we have not been prepared to really face up to the issue. Of course, you can gloss that up in rather more acceptable arguments. You'll have heard the adage, hard cases make bad law. Taking a really difficult case and using it to generate principles that we use in more ordinary ones is really tricky, and it's reasonable the courts get worried about that. And our system doesn't make it very easy to make sure that the judges understand all the ramifications of what's before them, because we've fundamentally set it up as a fight between two people. And there are lots of other people who may have a stake and be affected by this who don't have a voice in court. And we're getting a bit better. So in these life and death issues, pressure groups are able to make representations of the court and explain the evidence as they see it. But you see lots of problems of tactics, including attempts to silence some experts because they're not thought to be appropriate, or that they're thought to be too influential and wanting the chance to cross-examine them. So we have a system where the courts have been sucked towards the centre of the decision-making process, which only makes sense if what's at stake is a fundamental human right, because if you have a fundamental human right, we have a system in which it's part of the job of the courts to remind Parliament that they're breaching human rights and make them think again. Unlike the US system, where they can actually tell them what the Constitution requires of them, our judges can only tell Parliament that they haven't yet got the right answer. But even that they've ducked in this latest set of cases. So you'll see that for whatever range of reasons, Parliament, I don't think, has done very well. The courts haven't done very well. Could we find a way of addressing this in a more satisfactory matter? Well, I mentioned referenda earlier. Famously, the state of Oregon in the USA has used a referendum to pass legislation permitting assisted dying. And the interpretation of exactly what went on that remains, I think, contested. But one of the interesting things about it is that they didn't like the first referendum because it was too tight. It was roughly the same as our Brexit referendum. So they redid it. And seizing an opportunity, many of the Christian churches started a campaign to try and promote opposition to assisted dying. Now, the church's positions on euthanasia and dying are actually quite mixed. So I'm not one to say here that there is a Christian position on it. We can certainly talk about that a bit later. But there was a coalition in Oregon of both Roman Catholic and Protestant churches pushing an argument that we shouldn't take the step towards, they shouldn't take the step towards assisted dying, to which the community's response was to vote quite strongly in favor of assisted dying. Now, whether that was a feeling of bad faith, you know, that people were trying to impose views, whether it was a reflection on the arguments, who knows? But it does suggest to us that just counting numbers is open to change. These are referenda weren't very far apart, and yet quite significant difference. So what is it that we would hope to do if we address these things more sensibly? Well, counting votes sort of doesn't address the concerns that I addressed early on. You know what people went for, but you don't know why they went for it. So if we think these matters are important and we need to understand what's at stake and not just talk past each other, we should understand why people think things. Secondly, it's quite common for us to make assumptions on things when we reach conclusions that we're not very well placed to judge. And if we get into debate with each other, we can tease out things like, is it likely that if we were to admit assisted dying, the rates of people using that opportunity would be very high or very low? So one of the arguments that's used by campaigners is that people go quickly to Switzerland because they have to be able to go there when they can organise their travel themselves and are reasonably able-bodied, which they wouldn't need to do if they knew something equivalent would be available to them should they need it later on. That argument was very persuasive in Canada when Canada decided that there was a human right to end your life. There's evidence from Oregon that suggests that it's plausible, because there are significant numbers of people in Oregon who have the authorization to have medication take their own life who don't take it up. So that raises a question about what do we need to know in order to make a careful judgment about this. Which of those claims do we think is supportive? I'm going to illustrate one thing from my own experience and then try and draw some strands together to open up discussion. I sat on the organ donation task force in 2008 that was asked to consider whether we should move to a presumed consent system to organ donation. So this is a version of a system that says unless you've decided you don't want to be a donor, your organs, retina, skin, blood, whatever, it's all fair game to help someone else live. We took the view at that stage that it wasn't the time to take that step. We did it because our assessment of the available evidence from various different places, but most importantly from Spain, was that the legal change didn't make much difference. It made a lot of difference if you improved the willingness of health professionals to ask people where they want to be donors. It made a lot of difference if you could more efficiently get organs from where they were donated to where they were needed, and that those were the priorities. But we did one of these things sometimes called citizens' juries, big deliberative process, got people together to talk about what's going on. And what we found was that the feedback from that process was that people wanted presumed consent because they wanted more transplants. And yet our evaluation was that those two things didn't follow one from the other. Well, it's a bit hard to tell whether we'll turn out to be right or wrong in the abstract. I'm very confident we were right at the time. And one of my reasons for thinking right at the time was that we were working through what we thought the media campaigns would be around the Organ Donation Task Force. Gordon Brown was the Prime Minister, and the Sunday Times ran a front page about Gordon Brown being not only after all your wealth, but also after your private parts. And in that context, the consequences of taking a legal step are going to be different than they would be when David Cameron says, we're a big society, you know, we should support each other, and one way you can do this and be altruistic is to allow people to have your organs after you die. Which makes us need to think quite carefully about what sort of democracy will help us make good quality decisions. Well, let me just make a few observations. It's got to pull together fact-checking, I guess would be the modern language. That's to say, if something matters a lot to you, you want to know whether the proposal in front of you has a good chance of achieving that or not a good chance of achieving it. And therefore, you need to be able to pull together not just your first thought, but also your thought after some deliberation. In Ireland, they've done this over their abortion decision-making. They've created a citizens' assembly which can call in experts to give witness, giving them time and space to talk to each other and coming out, first of all, with the view that they should have a second referendum and then informing how they should go about explaining that to people. And this is quite popular in academic circles, but rather more difficult to do. We've done it in this country around genetic information and the best way we should take advantage of that. So what's at stake in the life and death issues? Well, we've touched on the ideas of autonomy, that why shouldn't someone be able to control their own death? But autonomy can mean lots of different things to people. So it can mean no one else should decide, only me. So that's a sort of control from outside. It could mean that I should just be able to do whatever I want whenever I want it. Rowan Williams, former Archbishop of Canterbury, has written quite eloquently about the way in which our consumer society assumes that none of our choices are connected, that what I wanted on Tuesday doesn't have to be the same as I want today, whereas a proper sense of control of our own lives would assume that we had some values that were consistent over time. So that leads us to thinking, well, if you think it matters a lot whether someone has taken a careful decision to die, what are your mechanisms in order to make sure that this is an example of that? And I've touched on the things that people think about at the moment in terms of you get two doctors to sign, a relative sign, and go to a judge and say, we've got reasons to think that actually this is a consistent, clearly held, deliberate position, not something that he's just thought of because he happened to have just seen a film in which there was a euthanasia, or he'd been to a talk by Matt Hansen and was inspired and really wanted to be able to have a controlled life, but he's never going to live up to the expectation of that, and now feels awful about himself and wants to just end it all now. So we should be thinking a bit about, well, what does it take to give people control? And that might mean we go a lot broader than changing the law on assisted dying. One of the arguments that people often make is that if we simply were to think this problem could go away if we let people give people help killing themselves? Where will our investment in palliative care, where will our support for other options come from that? And that's a very serious question. It's not obvious what the answer is, because the Dutch system is not bad on palliative care and has had this for a long time. But it's certainly something you'd really want to think through before you just thought we could allow someone to flick a button. Second sort of thing at stake is we worry about things going wrong. So we worry about whether or not, if we were to allow this step to happen, people who are weak and vulnerable would be coerced into decisions that were not really their decisions, that people wanted them to take. I used to slip my father, who's been 90 in September, you know, little cuttings about pass your property onto your kids while they can still use it. And now I'm having to do that for my own kids. But if you thought someone's expressed wish to die was actually someone saying, look, your life insurance is going to run out in 3 weeks' time, and actually this is the time for you to go, you would think that that might not be a very satisfactory position. Although there is an argument that says that if I chose to make sure that my kids got my money rather than it being eaten up in care home funds, why shouldn't I be able to do that? And Baroness Honora O'Neill, who's one of the world's most celebrated philosophers, made that argument in the House of Lords. We have a strong sense that there's something really important about life and that we shouldn't give up on it lightly. But we have a glib phrase, which we were exploring before the talk this evening, around sanctity of life, and we don't quite know whether we're using it in the same way. So do we mean life is inviolable, we could never give up on it, as the terminally ill requirement suggests? Do we mean life is really precious and valuable and should be lived to the full, in which case one stream of thought says, well, we should want to know what matters to individual people and what their sense of a full life is, and we should find a way of reflecting that in the options available to them. So all these things are at stake, and we need to decide what sort of solution we're hoping for. So one of them might be, well, lots of people in our society have different value systems. We need to try and make sure they live alongside each other and not impose one on the others. And that would lead us to a fairly permissive system, because we would be saying, as long as we're confident that people really have made these choices, it's nobody else's business, no one would be forced to use assisted suicide if it was permitted. So if you like, we can afford to do that for those who do want it without compromising the values of those who don't want it. You have a little issue about whether you give rights of conscience to clinicians and others involved, which we can touch on in conversations. But you could create that. And then you would be very interested in the safeguards, but you wouldn't really be interested in anything other than whether we knew this was a real decision and wasn't being subject to abuse. Or maybe you want to say that's giving up too easily, and that what we want to do is to say we do have common values, even if those common values are a bit elusive and even if they can't take us too far. And that might lead us to say, as I've said, we should be really cautious about this taking this step, because we do have a common value that life is precious. We don't necessarily agree what that means in every case, but we do have a view that you shouldn't just be allowed to do this because you choose. You have to go through some hurdles. You have to have some checks on it, because we're saying this is an unusual and extreme decision and should only be taken when we're very confident that it's right. And people who think like that work on these eligibility criteria that I touched on about, you know, the clinical eligibility, the autonomy eligibility, the safeguards in there. Or maybe we want a sort of more maximal idea of common values. And there is a school of thought that says we project what we care about and what we believe as a society in our rules. So the Swiss project that they, you know, are strongly supportive of autonomy, and they don't care about whether you're Swiss national or not Swiss national. They want to be able to support that. And we might see ourselves in a competitive world wanting to set out and say, as we do in things like assisted conception and embryo research, come to the UK because we have well-regulated services, because we want to do these things right. If we thought we could do this for euthanasia, we might say, actually, we're a place that could do this well, as our Prime Minister is currently wanting to say about artificial intelligence. I think that's a trap in many ways. I think it's very ambitious to try and deal with it. I wonder whether the best we can really do is to try and create a common conversation where we're, as I suggested, we tried to do at the beginning of my talk, wanting to talk to each other in terms where we understand each other, a degree of common language, common understanding of what's at stake, and committed to finding out how we might resolve those dilemmas. That broadly is the deliberative democracy model. We could do it through Parliament. Parliamentary select committees are pretty effective at giving people the chance to have a voice and persuade MPs. We could set it up separately. When the Falconer Commissioner looked at this, I and my colleagues in, I was working in Southampton at the time, decided not to give evidence to the Falconer Commission. It was a private commission set up by people with clear expectations of what they wanted the answer to be, which was that we should move towards a system of assisted dying. And we didn't want to give that legitimacy by putting in evidence. I said earlier, 1,200 people did. It's actually a very good report, very thorough. If you look at the evidence sessions, they've absolutely looked at the questions about whether they were biased, and they heard witnesses who said that they were, and worked that through. The legitimacy of that came, I think, through the fact that the public engaged with it and had its say. Whether you like the outcome or not, the outcome is worth taking seriously. We haven't yet reached that stage for the parliamentary process, and we haven't yet reached that stage through courts. But maybe if I sit down and you do it, we'll reach that stage this evening. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you, Jonathan. So we're going to have three minutes, write your questions down. If you've got them, stretch your legs, go to the loo, whatever, and we'll reconvene in about 3 minutes' time. Okay?